persecuted the Jewish underground, and acted against the Jewish immigration to the land of Israel. They were ordered to blow up British intelligence centers that acted against Jewish acquisition of weapons, and to take retaliatory action in cases where British military courts sentenced Haganah members to death. Ben-Gurion foresaw that a Jewish state would soon be established in Palestine, and that the new nation would immediately be forced to fight a war against Arabs in Palestine and repel invasions by the armies of neighboring Arab states. The Haganah command thus also began secretly preparing for this all-out war, and as part of the preparations, an order code named Zarzir, or Starling, was issued, providing for the assassination of the heads of the Arab population of Palestine. While the Haganah slowly stepped up the use of targeted killings, the radical undergrounds had their killing campaign in full motion, trying to push the British out of Palestine. Yitzhak Shamir, now in command of Lehi, resolved not only to eliminate key figures of the British mandate locally, killing CID personnel and making numerous attempts to do the same to the Jerusalem police chief, Michael Joseph McConnell, and the High Commissioner, Sir Harold McMichael, but also Englishmen in other countries who posed a threat to his political objective. Walter Edward Guinness, more formally known as Lord Moyne, for example, was the British resident Minister of State in Cairo, which was also under British rule. The Jews in Palestine considered Moyne a flagrant anti-Semite, who had assiduously used his position to restrict the Yeshuv's power by significantly reducing immigration quotas for Holocaust survivors. Shamir ordered Moyne killed. He sent two Lehi operatives, Eliyahu Hakim and Eliyahu Betzuri, to Cairo, where they waited at the door to Moyne's house. When Moyne pulled up his secretary in the car with him, Hakim and Betzuri sprinted to the car. One of them shoved a pistol through the window, aimed it at Moyne's head, and fired three times. Moyne gripped his throat. "Oh, they've shot us," he cried, and then slumped forward in his seat. Still, it was an amateurish operation. Shamir had counseled his young killers to arrange to escape in a car, but instead they fled on slow-moving bicycles. Egyptian police quickly apprehended them, and Hakim and Betzuri were tried, convicted, and 6 months later, hanged. The assassination had a decisive effect on British officials, though not the one Shamir had envisioned. As Israel would learn repeatedly in future years, it is very hard to predict how history will proceed after someone is shot in the head. After the unmitigated evil of the Holocaust, the attempted extermination of an entire people in Europe, there was growing sympathy in the West for the Zionist cause. According to some accounts, up until the first week of November 1944, Britain's Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, had been pushing his cabinet to support the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine. He rallied several influential figures to back the initiative, including Lord Moyne. It is not a stretch to assume, then, that Churchill might well have arrived at the Yalta summit with Franklin Roosevelt and Joseph Stalin with a clear, positive policy regarding the future of a Jewish state, had Lehi not intervened. Instead, after the Cairo killing, Churchill labeled the attackers a new group of gangsters and announced that he was reconsidering his position. And the killing continued. On July 22, 1946, members of Menachem Begin's Irgun planted 350-kilogram explosives in the south wing of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, where the British Mandate's administration and army and intelligence offices were housed. A warning call from the Irgun apparently was dismissed as a hoax. The building was not evacuated before a massive explosion ripped through it. 91 people were killed and 45 wounded. This was not the targeted killing of a despised British official or a guerrilla attack on a police station. Instead, it was plainly an act of terror, aimed at a target with numerous civilians inside. Most damningly, many Jews were among the casualties. The King David Hotel bombing sparked a fierce dispute in the Yeshuv. Ben-Gurion immediately denounced the Irgun and called it an enemy of the Jewish people. But the extremists were not deterred. 3 months after the King David attack, on October 31, a Lehi cell, again acting on their own without Ben-Gurion's approval or knowledge, bombed the British embassy in Rome. The embassy building was severely damaged, but thanks to the fact that the operation took place at night, only a security guard and two Italian pedestrians were injured. Almost immediately after that, Lehi mailed letter bombs to every senior British cabinet member in London. On one level, this effort was a spectacular failure. Not a single letter exploded. But on another, Lehi had made its point, and its reach, clear. The files of MI5, Britain's security service, showed that Zionist terrorism was considered the most serious threat to British national security at the time, even more serious than the Soviet Union. Irgun cells in Britain were established, according to one MI5 memo, to beat the dog in its own kennel. British intelligence sources warned of a wave of attacks on selected VIPs, among them Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin and even Prime Minister Clement Attlee himself. At the end of 1947, a report to the British High Commissioner tallied the casualties of the previous 2 years. 176 British Mandate personnel and civilians killed. Only these actions, these executions, caused the British to leave, David Shomron said, decades after he shot Tom Wilkin dead on a Jerusalem street. If Avraham Stern had not begun the war, the State of Israel would not have come into being. One may argue with these statements. The shrinking British Empire ceded control of the majority of its colonies, including many countries where terror tactics had not been employed due to economic reasons and increased demands for independence from the native populations. India, for instance, gained its independence right around the same time. Nevertheless, Shomron and his ilk were firmly convinced that their own bravery and their extreme methods had brought about the departure of the British. And it was the men who fought that bloody underground war, guerrillas, assassins, terrorists, who would play a central role in the building of the new state of Israel's armed forces and intelligence community. Chapter 2. A Secret World is Born. On November 29, 1947, the United Nations General Assembly voted to divide Palestine, carving out a sovereign Jewish homeland. The partition wouldn't go into effect until 6 months later, but Arab attacks began the very next day. Hassan Salameh, the commander of the Palestinian forces in the southern part of the country, and his fighters ambushed two Israeli buses near the town of Petah Tikva, murdering 8 passengers and injuring many others. Civil war between Palestinian Arabs and Jews had begun. The day after the bus attacks, Salameh stood in the central square of the Arab port city of Jaffa. "Palestine will turn into a bloodbath," he promised his countrymen. He kept that promise. During the next 2 weeks, 48 Jews were killed and 155 wounded. Salameh, who led a force of 500 guerrillas and even directly attacked Tel Aviv, became a hero in the Arab world, lionized in the press. The Egyptian magazine Al-Musawar published an enormous photograph of Salameh briefing his forces in its January 12, 1948 issue. Under the banner headline, "The Hero Hassan Salameh, Commander of the Southern Front." Ben-Gurion had prepared for such assaults. To his thinking, Palestine's Arabs were the enemy, and the British, who would continue to rule until the partition took formal effect in May 1948, were their abettors. The Jews could depend only on themselves and their rudimentary defenses. Most of the Haganah troops were poorly trained and poorly equipped, their arms hidden in secret caches to avoid confiscation by the British. They were men and women who had served in the British Army, bolstered by new immigrants who had survived the Holocaust, some of them Red Army veterans, but they were vastly outnumbered by the combined forces of the Arab states. Ben-Gurion was aware of the estimations of the CIA and other intelligence services that the Jews would collapse under Arab attack. Some of his own people weren't confident of victory, but Ben-Gurion, at least outwardly, displayed confidence in the Haganah's ability to win. To bridge the numerical gap, the Haganah's plan, then, was to use selective force, picking targets for maximum effectiveness. As part of this conception, a month into the Civil War, its high command launched Operation Starling, which named 23 leaders of the Palestinian Arabs who were to be targeted. The mission, according to Haganah's commander-in-chief, Yaakov Dori, was threefold. Elimination or capture of the leaders of the Arab political parties, strikes against political centers, strikes against Arab economic and manufacturing centers. Hassan Salameh was at the top of the list of targets. Under the leadership of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and spiritual leader of the Palestinian Arabs, Salameh had helped lead the Arab Revolt of 1936, in which Arab guerrillas for 3 years attacked both British and Jewish targets. Both al-Husseini and Salameh fled Palestine after they were put on the British Mandate's most wanted list. In 1942, they joined forces with the SS and the Abwehr, the Nazis' military intelligence agency, to plot Operation Atlas. It was a grandiose plan in which German and Arab commandos would parachute into Palestine and poison Tel Aviv's water supply in order to kill as many Jews as possible, rousing the country's Arabs to fight a holy war against the British occupiers. It failed miserably when the British, having cracked the Nazis' Enigma code, captured Salameh and four others after they dropped into a desert ravine near Jericho on October 6, 1944. After World War II, the British released al-Husseini and Salameh. The Jewish agency's political department, which oversaw much of the Yishuv's covert activity in Europe, tried to locate the former and kill him several times between 1945 and 1948. The motive was partly revenge for the Mufti's alliance with Hitler, but it was also defensive. Al-Husseini might have been out of the country, but he was still actively involved in organizing attacks on Jewish settlements in northern Palestine and in attempts to assassinate Jewish leaders. Due to a lack of intelligence and trained operational personnel, all those attempts failed. The hunt for Salameh, the first Haganah operation to integrate human and electronic intelligence, began promisingly. A unit belonging to Shai, the Haganah's intelligence branch, and commanded by Isser Harel, tapped into the central telephone trunk line that connected Jaffa with the rest of the country. Harel had a tool shed built on the grounds of the nearby Mikveh Israel Agricultural School and filled it with pruning shears and lawnmowers. But hidden in a pit under the floor was a listening device clipped to the copper wires of Yaffa's phone system. I'll never forget the face of the Arabic-speaking Shai operative who put on a set of headphones and listened to the first conversation, Harel later wrote in his memoir. His mouth gaped in astonishment, and he waved his hand emotionally to silence the others who were tensely waiting. The lines were bursting with conversations that political leaders and the chiefs of armed contingents were conducting with their colleagues. One of the speakers was Salameh. In one of the intercepted calls, Shai learned he would be traveling to Jaffa. Haganah agents planned to ambush him by felling a tree to block the road on which his car would be traveling. But the ambush failed, and it was not the last failure. Salameh survived multiple assassination attempts before falling in combat in June 1948, his killer unaware of his identity. Almost all of the other Operation Starling targeted killing bids also failed because of faulty intelligence or flawed performances by the unskilled and inexperienced hitmen. The only operations that did succeed were all carried out by two of the Haganah's elite units, both of which belonged to the Palmach, the militia's only well-trained and fairly well-armed corps. One of these units was the Palyam, the Marine Company, and the other was the Arab Platoon, a clandestine commando unit whose members operated disguised as Arabs. Palyam, the naval company, was ordered to take over the port in Haifa, Palestine's most important maritime gateway, as soon as the British departed. Its task was to steal as much of the weaponry and equipment the British were beginning to ship out as possible, and to prevent the Arabs from doing likewise. We focused on the Arab arms acquirers in Haifa and the north. We searched for them and killed them, recalled Avraham Dar, one of the Palyam men. Dar, who was a native English speaker, and two other Palyam men posed as British soldiers wanting to sell stolen gear to the Palestinians for a large amount of cash. A rendezvous was set up for the exchange near an abandoned flour mill on the outskirts of an Arab village. The three Jews, wearing British uniforms, were at the meeting place when the Palestinians arrived. Four others who were hiding nearby waited for the signal, and then fell upon the Arabs, killing them with metal pipes. We feared that gunshots would wake the neighbors, and we decided on a silent operation, said Dar. The Arab platoon was established when the Haganah decided it needed a nucleus of trained fighters who could operate deep inside enemy lines, gathering information and carrying out sabotage and targeted killing missions. The training of its men, most of them immigrants from Arab lands, included commando tactics and explosives, but also intensive study of Islam and Arab customs. They were nicknamed the Saravim, the name by which Jewish communities went in some Arab countries, where they practiced the Jewish religion, but were similar to the Arabs in all other respects, dress, language, social customs, etc. Cooperation between the two units produced an attempt on the life of Sheikh Nimr al-Khatib, a head of the Islamic Organizations of Palestine, one of the original targets of Operation Starling, because of his considerable influence over the Palestinian street. The Mistaravim could move around without being stopped by either the British or the Arabs. In February 1948, they ambushed al-Khatib when he returned from a trip to Damascus with a carload of ammunition. He was badly wounded, left Palestine, and removed himself from any active political roles. A few days later, Avraham Dar heard from one of his port worker informants that a group of Arabs in a cafe had been talking about their plan to detonate a vehicle packed with explosives in a crowded Jewish section of Haifa. The British ambulance that they had acquired for this purpose was being readied in a garage in Nazareth Road, in the Arab part of the city. The Misaravim prepared a bomb of their own in a truck that they drove into the Arab district, posing as workers engaged in fixing a burst pipe, and parked next to the wall of the garage. "What are you doing here? No parking here. Move the truck!" The men in the garage yelled at them in Arabic. "Right away, we're just getting a drink, and we need to take a leak," the Misaravim replied in Arabic, adding a few juicy curses. They walked away to a waiting car, and minutes later their bomb went off, detonating the one in the ambulance as well, and killing the five Palestinians working on it. On May 14, 1948, Ben-Gurion declared the establishment of the new state of Israel, and became its first prime minister and minister of defense. He knew what to expect next. Years earlier, Ben-Gurion had ordered the formation of a deep network of sources in the Arab countries. Now, 3 days before the establishment of Israel, Reuven Shiloah, director of the political department of the Jewish Agency, the agency's intelligence division, had informed him that the Arab states have decided finally to launch a simultaneous attack on May 15. They are relying on the lack of heavy armaments and a Hebrew air force. Shiloah provided many details about the attack plan. The information was accurate. At midnight, after the state was declared, seven armies attacked. They far outnumbered and were infinitely better equipped than the Jewish forces, and they achieved significant gains early on, conquering settlements and inflicting casualties. The Secretary General of the Arab League, Abdul Rahman Azam Pasha, declared, "This will be a war of great destruction and slaughter that will be remembered like the massacres carried out by the Mongols and the Crusaders." But the Jews, now officially Israelis, rapidly regrouped and even went on the offensive. After a month, a truce was mediated by the United Nations Special Envoy, Count Folk Bernadotte. Both sides were exhausted and in need of rest and resupply. When fighting resumed, the tables were turned and, with excellent intelligence and battle management, along with the help of many Holocaust survivors who had only just arrived from Europe, the Israelis drove the Arab forces back and eventually conquered far more territory than had been allocated to the Jewish state in the UN partition plan. Though Israel had repelled superior armies, Ben-Gurion was not sanguine about the embryonic Israel Defense Force's short-term victory. The Arabs might have lost the first battles, but they, both those who lived in Palestine and those in the Arab states surrounding Israel, refused to accept the legitimacy of the new nation. They vowed to destroy Israel and return the refugees to their homes. Ben-Gurion knew the IDF couldn't hope to defend Israel's long, convoluted borders through sheer manpower. From the remnants of the Haganah's shy intelligence operations, he had to begin building a proper espionage system fit for a legitimate state. On June 7, Ben-Gurion summoned his top aides, headed by Shiloh, to his office in the former Templar colony in Tel Aviv. "Intelligence is one of the military and political tools that we urgently need for this war," Shiloh wrote in a memo to Ben-Gurion. "It will have to become a permanent tool, including in our peacetime political apparatus." Ben-Gurion did not need to be persuaded. After all, a large part of the surprising, against-all-odds establishment of the state and its defense was owed to the effective use of accurate intelligence. That day, he ordered the establishment of three agencies. The first was the Intelligence Department of the Israel Defense Forces General Staff, later commonly referred to by its Hebrew acronym, Aman. Second was the Shin Bet, acronym for the General Security Service, responsible for internal security and created as a sort of hybrid between the American FBI and the British MI5. The organization later changed its name to the Israeli Security Agency, but most Israelis still refer to it by its acronym, Shabak, or more commonly, as in this book, as Shin Bet. And a third, the Political Department, now belonging to the new Foreign Ministry instead of the Jewish Agency, would engage in foreign espionage and intelligence collection. Abandoned Templar homes in the Sarona neighborhood, near the Defense Ministry, were assigned to each outfit, putting Ben-Gurion's office at the center of an ostensibly organized force of security services. But nothing in those first months and years was so tidy. Remnants of Haganah agencies were absorbed into various security services or spy rings, then shuffled and reabsorbed into another. Add to that the myriad turf battles and clashing egos of what were essentially revolutionaries, and much was chaos in the espionage underground. "They were hard years," said Isser Harel, one of the founding fathers of Israeli intelligence. "We had to establish a country and defend it. But the structure of the services and the division of labor was determined without any systematic judgment, without discussions with all the relevant people, and in an almost dilettantish and conspiratorial way." Under normal conditions, administrators would establish clear boundaries and procedures, and field agents would patiently cultivate sources of information over a period of years. But Israel did not have this luxury. Its intelligence operations had to be built on the fly and under siege, while the young country was fighting for its very existence. The first challenge that Ben-Gurion's spies faced was an internal one. There were Jews who blatantly defied his authority, among them the remnants of the right-wing underground movements. An extreme example of this defiance was the Altalena affair in June 1948. A ship by that name, dispatched from Europe by the Irgun, was due to arrive, carrying immigrants and arms. But the organization refused to hand all the weapons over to the army of the new state, insisting that some of them be given to still intact units of its own. Ben-Gurion, who had been informed of the plans by agents inside Irgun, ordered that the ship be taken over by force. In the ensuing fight, it was sunk, and 16 Irgun fighters and 3 IDF soldiers were killed. Shortly afterward, security forces rounded up 200 Irgun members all over the country, effectively ending its existence. Yitzhak Shamir and the Lehi operatives under his command also refused to accept the more moderate Ben-Gurion's authority. Over the summer, during the truce, UN envoy Bernadotte crafted a tentative peace plan that would have ended the fighting. But the plan was unacceptable to Lehi and Shamir, who accused Bernadotte of collaborating with the Nazis during World War II, and of drafting a proposal that would redraw Israeli borders in such a way, including giving most of the Negev and Jerusalem to the Arabs, and putting the Haifa port and Lida airport under international control, as well as obliging the Jewish state to take back 300,000 Arab refugees, that the country would not survive. Lehi issued several public warnings, in the form of notices posted in the streets of cities. Advice to the agent Bernadotte, clear out of our country. The underground radio was even more outspoken, declaring, "The Count will end up like the Lord," a reference to the assassinated Lord Moyne. Bernadotte ignored the warnings, and even ordered UN observers not to carry arms, saying, "The United Nations flag protects us." Convinced that the envoy's plan would be accepted, Shamir ordered his assassination. On September 17, 4 months after statehood was declared, and the day after Bernadotte submitted his plan to the UN Security Council, he was traveling with his entourage in a convoy of three white DeSoto sedans from UN headquarters to the Rehavia neighborhood of Jewish Jerusalem, when a jeep blocked their way. Three young men wearing peaked caps jumped out. Two of them shot the tires of the UN vehicles, and the third, Yehoshua Cohen, opened the door of the car Bernadotte was traveling in, and opened fire with his Schmeisser MP40 submachine gun. The first burst hit the man sitting next to Bernadotte, a French colonel by the name of André Soreau, but the next, more accurate, hit the Count in the chest. Both men were killed. The whole attack was over in seconds. Like thunder and lightning, the time it takes to fire 50 rounds, is the way the Israeli liaison officer, Captain Moshe Hillman, who was in the car with the victims, described it. The perpetrators were never caught. The assassination infuriated and profoundly embarrassed the Jewish leadership. The Security Council condemned it as a cowardly act, which appears to have been committed by a criminal group of terrorists in Jerusalem. And the New York Times wrote the following day, "No Arab armies could have done so much harm to the Jewish state in so short a time." Ben-Gurion saw Lehi's rogue operation as a serious challenge to his authority, one that could lead to a coup or even a civil war. He reacted immediately, outlawing both the Irgun and Lehi. He ordered Shin Bet chief Isser Harel to round up Lehi members. Topping the wanted list was Yitzhak Shamir. He wasn't captured, but many others were, and they were locked up under heavy guard. Lehi ceased to exist as an organization. Ben-Gurion was grateful to Harel for his vigorous action against the underground and made him the number one intelligence official in the country. A short, solid, and driven man, Isser Harel was influenced by the Russian Bolshevik revolutionary movement and its use of sabotage, guerrilla warfare, and assassination, but he abhorred communism. Under his direction, the Shin Bet kept constant surveillance and conducted political espionage against Ben-Gurion's political opponents, the left-wing socialist and communist parties, and the right-wing Herut party, formed by veterans of Irgun and Lehi. Meanwhile, Ben-Gurion and his foreign minister, Moshe Sharet, were at loggerheads over what policy should be adopted toward the Arabs. Sharet was the most prominent of Israel's early leaders, who believed diplomacy was the best way to achieve regional peace and thus secure the country. Even before independence, he made secret overtures to Jordan's King Abdullah and Lebanon's Prime Minister Riyad al-Sul, who would be instrumental in forming the coalition of invading Arabs, and who already had been largely responsible for the Palestinian militias that exacted heavy losses on the pre-state Yishuv. Despite al-Sul's virulently anti-Jewish rhetoric and anti-Israel actions, he secretly met with Eliyahu Sasson, one of Sharet's deputies, several times in Paris in late 1948, to discuss a peace agreement. "If we want to establish contacts with the Arabs to end the war," said Sasson when Sharet, enthusiastic about his secret contacts, took him to report to the cabinet. We have to be in contact with those people who are now in power, with those who have declared war on us and who are having trouble continuing. Those diplomatic overtures obviously were not effective, and Ben-Gurion, on December 12, 1948, ordered military intelligence agents to assassinate Al-Soh. Charette was vehemently opposed to the idea, recalled Asher, Arthur, Ben-Natan, a leading figure in the Foreign Ministry's political department, the arm responsible for covert activities abroad. And when our department was asked to help military intelligence execute the order, through our contacts in Beirut, he countermanded the order, effectively killing it. This incident, plus a number of other clashes between Harel and Charette, made Ben-Gurion's blood boil. He considered diplomacy a weak substitute for a strong military and robust intelligence, and he viewed Charette, personally, as a competitor who threatened the Prime Minister's control. In December 1949, Ben-Gurion removed the political department from the control of the Foreign Ministry and placed it under his direct command. He later gave the agency a new name, the Institute for Intelligence and Special Operations. More commonly, though, it was known simply as the Institute, the Mossad. With the establishment of the Mossad, Israeli intelligence services coalesced into the three-pronged community that survives in more or less the same form today. Amman, the military intelligence arm that supplies information to the IDF. The Shin Bet, responsible for internal intelligence, counter-terror, and counter-espionage. And the Mossad, which deals with covert activities beyond the country's borders. More important, it was a victory for those who saw the future of the Israeli state as more dependent upon a strong army and intelligence community than upon diplomacy. That victory was embodied in real estate. The former Templar homes in Tel Aviv that the political department had occupied were handed over to the Mossad. It was also a personal victory for Isser Harel. Already in charge of the Shin Bet, he was installed as the chief of the Mossad as well, making him one of the most powerful and secretive figures in early Israeli history. From that point on, Israeli foreign and security policy would be determined by jousting between Tel Aviv, where the military high command, the intelligence headquarters, and the defense ministry were located, and where Ben-Gurion spent most of his time, and Jerusalem, where the foreign ministry was housed in a cluster of prefabricated huts. Tel Aviv always had the upper hand. Ben-Gurion kept all of the agencies under his direct control. The Mossad and the Shin Bet were under him in his capacity as prime minister, and military intelligence fell under his purview because he was also minister of defense. It was an enormous concentration of covert and political power. Yet from the beginning, it was kept officially hidden from the Israeli public. Ben-Gurion forbade anyone from acknowledging, let alone revealing, that this sprawling web of official institutions even existed. In fact, mentioning the name Shin Bet or Mossad in public was prohibited until the 1960s. Because their existence could not be acknowledged, Ben-Gurion prevented the creation of a legal basis for those same agencies' operations. No law laid out their goals, roles, missions, powers, or budgets, or the relations between them. In other words, Israeli intelligence from the outset occupied a shadow realm, one adjacent to, yet separate from, the country's democratic institutions. The activities of the intelligence community, most of it Shin Bet and the Mossad, under the direct command of the Prime Minister, took place without any effective supervision by Israel's parliament, the Knesset, or by any other independent external body. In this shadow realm, state security was used to justify a large number of actions and operations that, in the visible world, would have been subject to criminal prosecution and long prison terms. Constant surveillance of citizens because of their ethnic or political affiliations. Interrogation methods that included prolonged detention without judicial sanction and torture. Perjury in the courts, and concealment of the truth from counsel and judges. The most notable example was targeted killing. In Israeli law, there was no death penalty, but Ben-Gurion circumvented this by giving himself the authority to order extrajudicial executions. The justification for maintaining that shadow realm was that anything other than complete secrecy could lead to situations that would threaten the very existence of Israel. Israel had inherited from the British Mandate a legal system that included state of emergency provisions to enforce order and suppress rebellions. Among those provisions was a requirement that all print and broadcast media submit any reports on intelligence and army activities to a military censor, who vetoed much of the material. The state of emergency has not been rescinded as of the time of this writing. But as a sop to the hungry media, Ben-Gurion was shrewd enough to establish an editor's committee, which was composed of the editors-in-chief of the print and radio news outlets. From time to time, Ben-Gurion himself, or someone representing him, would appear before the committee to share covert tidbits, while explaining why those tidbits could never, under any circumstances, be released to the public. The editors were thrilled because they had gained for themselves entree to the Twilight Realm and its mysteries. In gratitude, they imposed on themselves a level of self-censorship that went beyond even that imposed by the actual censor. In July 1952, an exhibit of paintings by the Franco-German artist Charles Duval opened at the National Museum in Cairo. Duval, a tall young man with a cigarette permanently dangling from his lip, had moved to Egypt from Paris 2 years earlier, announcing that he'd fallen in love with the land of the Nile. The Cairo press published a number of fawning pieces about Duval and his work, strongly influenced, the critics said, by Picasso, and he soon became a fixture in high society. Indeed, the Egyptian Minister of Culture attended the opening of Duval's show and even purchased two of the paintings that he left on loan to the museum, where they would hang for the next 23 years. 5 months later, when his show had closed, Duval said that his mother had fallen ill and he had to rush back to Paris to care for her. After his return to France, he sent a few letters to old friends in Egypt, and then he was never heard from again. Duval's real name was Shlomo Cohen Abravanel, and he was an Israeli spy. He was the youngest of four sons born to a prominent rabbi in Hamburg in Germany. In the winter of 1933, as the Nazis rose to power and began enforcing race laws, the family fled to France and then Palestine. 15 years later, in 1947, Cohen Abravanel, whose artistic abilities had been apparent since he was a toddler, returned to Paris to study painting at the age of 27. A short time later, Haganah intelligence personnel heard about his talents and recruited him to forge passports and papers to be used by European and North African Jews being smuggled into Palestine in violation of British immigration laws. It was the beginning of a long career in espionage. Portraying himself as a bohemian artist, Cohen Abravanel operated networks of agents in Egypt and recruited new agents throughout the Arab world. He collected information about Nazi war criminals who had taken refuge in the Middle East, and he reported to his superiors on the initial attempts of German rocket scientists to sell their services to Arab armies. When he returned to Israel in 1952, he pushed his superiors in the young intelligence agency, the Mossad, to invest more resources into finding and killing Nazis. A short time after taking command of the Mossad, Isser Harel asked Cohen Abravanel to design an official emblem for the agency. The artist shut himself in his room and emerged with a design, which he'd drawn by hand. At its center was a seven-branched menorah, the sacred lamp that stood in the temple in Jerusalem that the Romans destroyed in A.D. 70. The seal also bore a legend. Verse 6 from chapter 24 of the book of Proverbs, authored, according to Jewish tradition, by King Solomon himself. For by subterfuge you will make war. This was later changed to another line from Proverbs, chapter 11, verse 14, which reads, where there is no subterfuge, the nation falls. But in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. Cohen Arbarbanel's meaning could not have been clearer. Using covert stratagems, the Mossad would be the supreme shield of the new Jewish Commonwealth, ensuring that never again would Jews be dishonored, that never again would Judea fall. The Mossad's charter, written by Harel, was equally broad and ambitious. The organization's purpose, according to its official orders, was secret collection of information, strategic, political, operational, outside the country's borders, carrying out special operations outside Israel's borders, thwarting the development and acquisition of unconventional weapons by hostile states, prevention of terror attacks against Israeli and Jewish targets outside Israel, development and maintenance of intelligence and political ties with countries that do not maintain diplomatic relations with Israel, bringing to Israel Jews from countries that refused to allow them to leave, and creating frameworks for the defense of the Jews still in those countries. In other words, it was charged with not only protecting Israel and its citizens, but also standing as a sentinel for world Jewry. Israel's young intelligence services had to offer a response to a series of challenges presented by the ring of 21 hostile Arab nations that surrounded Israel and threatened to destroy it. There were those in the top echelons of the defense establishment who believed that these challenges would best be met by the use of pinpointed special operations far beyond enemy lines. To this end, Amman set up a unit called Intelligence Service 13, which in Jewish tradition is considered a lucky number. Avraham Dar, now one of its prominent officers, went to Egypt in 1951 to set up a network of agents called from local Zionist activists. On various pretexts, the recruits traveled to Europe and then to Israel for training in espionage and sabotage. Outlining the goal of his network, Dar explained that the central problem that made Egypt so antagonistic to Israel was the way King Farouk ran the government. If we could get rid of that obstacle, many problems would be solved. In other words, and here Dar turned to a Spanish proverb, no dog, no rabies. Getting rid of the dog proved to be unnecessary. Farouk soon was overthrown in a coup, and Amman's assumption that things would be better when he was gone turned out to be totally groundless. However, the idea that this already established Egyptian network could be employed to change the course of history in the region was simply too tempting for Israel's leaders to let go. Amman decided to use these local agents against the Free Officers Movement, which had just recently ousted Farouk, aiming to undermine Western confidence in the Egyptian regime by causing public insecurity and provoking demonstrations, arrests, and retaliatory actions, with Israel's role remaining unexposed. But the whole operation ended in catastrophe. Despite intensive training, Amman's recruits were amateurish and sloppy, and all of their sabotage operations ended in failure. Eventually, 11 operatives were ferreted out by Egyptian authorities. Some were executed after short trials, and one killed himself after suffering gruesome torture. The lucky ones were sentenced to long prison terms and hard labor. The ensuing turmoil gave rise to a major political dispute that raged in Israel for many years over whether Amman had received the approval of the political establishment for these abortive operations. The main lesson drawn by Israel was that local Jews should never be recruited in hostile target countries. Their capture was almost certain to end in death and send ripples throughout the entire Jewish community. Despite the temptation to use people who were already on the ground and didn't need to establish a cover story, Israel almost never again did. However, the underlying conviction that Israel could act boldly and change history through special operations behind enemy lines remained, and was in fact cemented in place as the core principle of Israel's security doctrine. Indeed, this philosophy, that special ops behind enemy lines should be at least one of the country's primary methods of national defense, would predominate among Israel's political and intelligence establishment all the way up to the present day. And while many of the world's established nations kept a separation between the intelligence outfits that gathered information and the operations units that utilized that information to conduct clandestine missions, from the very beginning, Israel's special forces were an integral part of its intelligence agencies. In America, for instance, Special Operations Units Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 are components of the Joint Special Operations Command, not the CIA or military intelligence. In Israel, however, Special Operations Units were under the direct control of the intelligence agencies Mossad and Amman. The goal was to continually translate gathered intelligence into operations. While other nations at the time were also gathering intelligence during peacetime, they did so only to be prepared in case war broke out, or to authorize the occasional special ops attack. Israel, on the other hand, would constantly use its intelligence to develop special ops attacks behind enemy lines, in the hope of avoiding all-out warfare entirely. The fashioning of an emblem, a charter, and a military philosophy was one thing. Implementation, as Harel was soon to learn, was another thing altogether, especially when it came to aggressive action. The Mossad's first major operation ended badly. In November 1954, a captain in the Israeli Navy named Alexander Yisraeli, a philandering grifter deeply in debt, slipped out of the country on a bogus passport and tried to sell top-secret documents to the Egyptian embassy in Rome. A Mossad agent working in that embassy tipped off his superiors in Tel Aviv, who immediately began to develop a plan to kidnap Yisraeli and return him to Israel for trial as a traitor. For Harel, this was a critical test, both for the security of the nation and his career. In those formative years, the heads of all the agencies jockeyed for power and prestige, and one significant failure could prove professionally fatal. He assembled a top-notch team of Mossad and Shin Bet operatives to grab Yisraeli in Europe. He put his second cousin, Rafi Eitan, who as a teenager had assassinated two German Templars, in charge. Eitan says that there were some who proposed finding Yisraeli and killing him as quickly as possible, but Harel squelched this immediately. "We don't kill Jews," he said, and declared this was to be an abduction operation. Harel himself said, "It never occurred to me to issue an order to kill one of our own. I wanted him to be brought to Israel and put on trial for treason." This is an important point. There is a tradition of mutual responsibility in Judaism, and a deep connection among all Jews, as if they are one big family. These values are seen as having kept the Jewish people alive as a nation throughout the 2,000 years of exile, and for a Jew to harm another Jew is considered intolerable. Back in the days of the Palestinian underground, when it was effectively impossible to hold trials, eliminating Jewish traitors was deemed legitimate to a certain extent, but not after the state was established. "We do not kill Jews," even if they were believed to be a grave danger to national security, became an iron law of the Israeli intelligence community. The plan unfolded perfectly at first. Eitan and three others pinched Yisraeli after he'd been stopped by another Mossad female asset at a Paris intersection. The captive was taken to a safe house, where a Mossad doctor injected him with a sedative and placed him in a crate typically used to transfer arms, before putting him on a long, multi-stop flight on an Israeli Air Force cargo plane. At every stop, Yisraeli was injected again until, just as the plane touched down in Athens, he suffered a massive seizure and died. Following Harel's orders, one of Eitan's men ended up dumping the body from the back of the plane into the sea. Harel's people fed the Israeli press false information that Yisraeli, who left behind a pregnant wife, had stolen money and settled somewhere in South America. Harel, who was very embarrassed that an operation of his had ended in the death of a Jew, ordered that all the records on the case be secreted deep in one of the Mossad's safes. but Harel's rivals kept a copy of some of the documents, to be used against him someday, if so required. Harel also came to the conclusion that there was an urgent need for the formation of a special unit specifically designed to carry out sabotage and targeted killing missions. He began searching for trained fighters, tough and loyal, who would not hesitate to squeeze the trigger when necessary. He found them in the last place he would have been expected to look, the veterans of the Irgun and Lehi, against whom he had once fought a bitter struggle. Ben-Gurion had forbidden the employment of any former members of the right-wing underground in government departments, and many of them were jobless, frustrated, and hungry for action. The Shin Bet believed that some of them were dangerous and were liable to start underground movements against the regime. Harel aimed to kill two birds, to set up his special ops unit, and to get the underground fighters into action under his command, outside the borders of the state. David Shomron, Yitzhak Shamir, and those of their comrades in the Irgun and Lehi, who were deemed tough and daring enough, were invited to Harel's home at North Tel Aviv and sworn in. This was the establishment of Mifratz, Hebrew for Gulf or Bay, the Mossad's first hit team. Chapter 3. The Bureau for Arranging Meetings with God. Israel's War of Independence officially ended with armistice agreements in 1949. The unofficial fighting never stopped. Throughout the early 1950s, the country was constantly infiltrated by Arabs from the parts of Palestine that remained in Arab hands after the war, namely the Gaza Strip in the south, which was administered by Egypt, and the West Bank in the east, which Jordan had annexed. The IDF estimated that in 1952, about 16,000 infiltrations occurred, 11,000 from Jordan and the rest from Egypt. Some of those infiltrators were refugees who had fled during the War of Independence, either voluntarily or involuntarily, and were trying to return to their villages and salvage what was left of their property. But many others were militants, whose objective was to kill Jews and spread terror. They called themselves Fedayeen, those who self-sacrifice. The Egyptians, despite having signed an armistice, quickly realized that the Fedayeen could fight a proxy war on their behalf. With proper training and supervision, those Palestinian militants could wreak substantial havoc on Israel while giving Egypt the cover of plausible deniability. A young captain in Egyptian military intelligence, Mustafa Hafez, was put in charge of organizing the Fedayeen. Beginning in mid-1953, Hafez, along with Salah Mustafa, the Egyptian military attaché in Jordan's capital, Amman, started recruiting and training guerrilla squads to be dispatched into Israel's south. For years, those squads, 600 Fedayeen in total, sneaked across the border from Gaza and laid waste to anything they could. They blew up water pipes, set fire to fields, bombed train tracks, mined roads. They murdered farmers in their fields and yeshiva students at study. Altogether, some 1,000 civilians between 1951 and 1955. They spread panic and fear to the point that Israelis refrained from driving at night on main roads in the south. The proxy squads were considered a huge success. The Israelis couldn't hold Egypt or Jordan directly responsible. They would respond instead by recruiting their own proxies, turning Arabs into informers, collecting intelligence on Fedayeen targets, and then assassinating them. Those tasks were assigned, for the most part, to an IDF intelligence team known as Unit 504. Some of the men of Unit 504 had been raised in Arab neighborhoods of Palestine, and thus were intimately familiar with the language and customs of the locals. Unit 504 was under the command of Rehavia Vardi. Polish-born, Vardi had served as a senior Haganah intelligence officer prior to the establishment of the state, and he was known for his sharp wit and blunt statements. "Every Arab," he said, "can be recruited on the basis of one of the three P's, praise, payment, or pussy." Whether through those three P's or other means, Vardi and his men recruited 400 to 500 agents who passed on invaluable information in the period between 1948 and 1956. Those recruits, in turn, provided Unit 504 with information on a number of senior Fedayeen dispatchers. Several were identified, located, and targeted, and in 10 to 15 of those cases, the Israelis persuaded their Arab agents to place a bomb near that target. That was when they would call Unit 188. That was when they required the services of Natan Rothberg. It was all very, very secret, Rothberg said. We were not allowed to mention the names of units. We were not allowed to tell anyone where we were going or where we were serving or, it goes without saying, what we were doing. Rothberg, a thick-necked and good-natured kibbutznik with a bushy mustache, was one of a small group, only a few hundred men, who took part in forming the original triumvirate of Amman, Shin Bet, and the Mossad. In 1951, when Rothberg was assigned to a Marine commando unit called Shayatet 13, Flotilla 13, Israeli intelligence set up a secret facility north of Tel Aviv to teach special demolitions and manufacture sophisticated bombs. Rothberg, Flotilla 13's explosives officer, was appointed to run it. Rothberg had a large vat installed in which he mixed TNT and pentaerythritol tetranitrate and other chemicals into deadly concoctions. But though his mixtures were designed to kill people, he claimed that he did not act with hatred in his heart. "You need to know how to forgive," he said. "You need to know how to forgive the enemy. However, we have no authority to forgive people like bin Laden. That only God can do. Our job is to arrange a meeting between them." In my laboratory, I opened a matchmaker's office, a bureau that arranged such meetings. I orchestrated more than 30 such meetings. When Rehavia Vardi and his men had identified a target, they would go to Rothberg for the bomb. "At first we worked with double-bottomed wicker baskets," Rothberg said. "I would cushion the bottom part of the basket with impermeable paper and pour the concoction in from the vat. Then we'd put on a cover and, above that, fill it up with fruits and vegetables. For the triggering mechanism, we used pencils into which we inserted ampules filled with acid that ate away at the cover until it reached the detonator, activated it, and set off the charge. The problem with the acid was that weather conditions affected the time it took to eat away the cover, producing non-uniform timing. A bomb in the Gaza Strip would go off at a different time than one in the West Bank, where it is generally colder. We then switched to clocks, which are much more accurate." But Rothberg's bombs were hardly enough to solve the Fedayeen problem. According to several sources, explosives killed only 7 targets between mid-1951 and mid-1953, while in the process killing 6 civilians. The attacks continued unabated, terrorizing Israeli civilians, humiliating the Israel Defense Forces. Vardi and his men, talented as they were at recruiting agents, managed to glean only sparse information about the identities of the Fedayeen handlers. And even when the unit did ferret out specific targets, the IDF was unable to find or kill them. "We had our limitations," says Yigal Simon, a Unit 504 veteran and later on its commander. "We didn't always have intelligence. We couldn't send our agents everywhere, and they didn't appreciate us enough in the IDF. It was important to the high command to show that the IDF, Jewish hands, could execute these actions." Regular IDF units did try several times to penetrate the Gaza Strip, Sinai, and Jordan to carry out retaliation attacks, but they repeatedly failed. Prime Minister Ben-Gurion accordingly decided to develop whatever capability the IDF lacked. At a secret meeting on June 11, 1953, the Israeli cabinet approved his recommendation that it authorize the Minister of Defense, Ben-Gurion himself, to approve acts of reprisal against the attacks and murders committed by those coming from beyond the Israel-Jordan armistice lines. Ben-Gurion used the authority vested in him to act a short time afterward. 2 guards at Evin Sapir, a settlement near Jerusalem, were murdered on May 25, and he ordered that an ad hoc secret detail be set up in order to do away with a Palestinian arch-terrorist by the name of Mustafa Samueli, who had been behind the slaying of the guards. Now, Ben-Gurion just needed the right man to lead it. Ariel Shinerman, better known as Ariel Sharon, was a 25-year-old student in the summer of 1953, but he already had extensive combat experience. He'd established himself as a leader from his days as a teenaged youth movement counselor and had proven his courage during the War of Independence, during which he had been badly wounded. Arik, as he was also known, was charismatic and authoritative, a warrior in top physical condition, and he didn't hesitate when the IDF general staff recruited him to eliminate Samueli. "My father immediately said yes," wrote Sharon's son Gilad in a biography of Ariel. "He was confident that with 7 or 8 good men, friends who'd served with him in the war and afterward, and with the right kit, he could do it." On the night of July 12, 1913, Sharon and a squad made up of reservists managed to get inside Samueli's village in the West Bank and blow his house up. But the intelligence they were given was flawed, and Samueli wasn't at home. The force got entangled in a firefight and made it out by the skin of their teeth. The high command saw the operation as a success, deep penetration of enemy territory, demonstration of its ability to hit a target, and returning to base without casualties. Sharon, by contrast, came back exhausted and totally dissatisfied. His conclusion was that such operations have to be carried out by professionals, something completely different from the random group of buddies he had taken with him that night. He told his superiors that there was a need for an elite commando unit. On August 10, Unit 101 came into being. This unit was set up for the purpose of operations across the border, those non-standard missions that demand special training and high-level performance, according to the 101 operations procedures, written by Sharon himself. Sharon was given free rein to select his own men, from reservist soldiers redrafted to the army as well as regular soldiers. He wanted to put them through a grueling, year-long training program. His fighters learned how to handle explosives, how to navigate over long distances, and how to fire accurately and precisely while on the run over mountainous terrain. Exercises that both developed their skills and instilled a sense of pride and confidence. The young leader made sure his men stood apart from the IDF regulars, arming them with a different personal weapon from the outdated bolt-action Czechoslovak rifle in use at the time. Instead, they were issued Carl Gustav submachine guns, and they were also the first to try out the new and still secret Israeli-made Uzi. Sharon also relaxed the rules of both dress and conduct. At their secret base in the Jerusalem mountains, the men of Unit 101 often worked entirely in civilian attire. To Sharon, the outward trappings of military order were of marginal use. More important was that his men believed they were special, better, the best, and that they trusted their commander. Sharon's operational briefings were precise and unequivocal, and he fought at the front of his battalion, often in the most vulnerable position, embodying the well-known motto of IDF commanders, "Follow me." Sharon was imbued with a limitless and unrestrained motivation to go on operations, and he grasped that if he had to wait for precise intelligence from Amman to carry out a targeted killing, he might never do anything. Accordingly, Sharon and Moshe Dayan, chief of the general staff, shifted tactics, abandoning pinpoint precision for something more primal. Rather than kill prime Palestinian terrorists, they would avenge the killings of Israelis by attacking and terrorizing the Arab villages from which the terrorists had set forth to harm Jews, as well as the army camps and police stations. "We cannot prevent the murder of workers in the orchards and of families in their beds," Dayan said in a lecture in 1955. "But we have the ability to